And welcome back. First ladies have always played an important role in this country, even in the nation's earliest days. History has left a remarkable record of their role in their husbands' personal and political lives. Starting tonight at 8 o'clock on C-SPAN on this President's Day, the role of First Ladies, including two from Missouri, will be detailed in the first of a 35-part series that will extend over the next year. It's titled First Ladies, Influence and Image. Its executive producer is Peabody Award-winning Mark Farkas. I spoke with him about it and asked about the difficulties in researching the project.
A lot of these first ladies were great letter writers, and so we have that for some of the season one. There are others that, you know, Elizabeth Monroe, the papers were burned. Actually, Martha Washington's letters were burned. And so there are other letters that exist from family members, accounts of them in the press. And so, there, you know, you got to do a little bit of digging to find what you need. But for almost all of them, we've been able to do that.
So you don't feel that there are necessarily major gaps in the information on some of the early ones in particular?
No. I mean, there are some, you know, we've combined some first ladies into a single program for Anna Harrison, Letitia Tyler, and Julia Tyler. I mean, you take a look at someone like Anna Harrison, her husband, you know, makes the longest recorded inaugural speech and dies a month later because of the pneumonia that he catches. And so she doesn't even make it to Washington. Letitia Tyler, John Tyler's wife, dies about a year into his term. And so then there's Julia Tyler, who really plays the role of first lady out of those three in a much larger way. And so for some of them where we don't really have enough to do a whole program on, we've combined two or three first ladies where we know that we do have one that really tells us a lot about them as first lady. But those other ones that we don't know a lot about, what we will learn in the programs will be new for everyone. And it's also a way to sort of take a look at what's going on in the time period as well.
What about video? I mean, you're going to be on television after all.
Well, season two is a lot easier. Once we get to the film and television era, we have first ladies actually in their own words, speaking on radio, television, and films. And for season one, again, the letters, you know, to see what they wrote is a real window into who they are as human beings, how they approach the role, what their relationship was with their husband. And, you know, there are surprisingly, this is one of the great surprises that we found when we decided to do the series. There are a number of people out there who now really have taken an interest in first ladies. And so it's an area of new scholarship. And so we've met a lot of mostly women who have really started to delve into these women's lives and write biographies and really try to figure out who they were.
You know, I read Cokie Roberts' book on the first ladies of our early history. And one of the things that struck me about that, and curious as to what your reaction to them was, is that they were very, very progressive, many of them, way ahead of their time in some cases.
Well, you know, Abigail Adams famously says, you know, don't forget the ladies. And that's, I'm paraphrasing her, but she is absolutely ahead of her time in lobbying her husband to not forget women's rights. And, you know, you even take a look at someone like Lucy Hayes, who's the first lady to get a college education. And again, during her time in office, you know, the women's suffrage movement is starting to take shape, and it's tied in with the temperance movement. People know Lucy Hayes as, you know, Lemonade Lucy for banning alcohol in the White House, but she's a woman, you know, who's again, first college-educated first lady, so sort of ahead of her time, but it was also a real window into what's going on in the country at that point.
How well-known were their views? Again, I'm focusing for the moment on the earliest first ladies. How well-known were their views and their positions on some of these issues?
Well, it just sort of depends on which first ladies, you know, you're taking a look at. I mean, but a lot of them are, you know, they're not taking on causes per se out in the open. They're more behind the scenes and lobbying with their husband for things that they want. I mean, I think a really good example is someone like Sarah Polk, who takes a very active role. You know, James K. Polk is the Speaker of the House, and so they don't have any children, and she's devoted her life to politics, and she's an equal partner with him. And then when he becomes president, she's still over in the halls of Congress, listening to congressional debates, reporting back to her husband, editing his speeches, lobbying him and giving him advice on, you know, which cabinet members to bring into the cabinet and which ones to get rid of. And so a lot of them are working behind the scenes to influence their husbands.
When did they begin to emerge from this background?
To me, I mean, the real turning point, I think, is obviously, you know, is Eleanor Roosevelt, who's the first lady who's really out there. I mean, she's the first lady to hold press conferences. Interestingly enough, you know, the press conferences are only female reporters are allowed into these press conferences. So you think of the cascading effect of that is all of a sudden these stodgy, you know, male editors have to hire female reporters. And so she's, you know, there's a Eleanor Hopper up there in FDR's office that she's lobbying for causes, you know, constantly with him. So she's the first one, in my opinion, who is really out in public about some of these things. But again, I would go back to somebody like Lucy Hayes, who is, you know, working on prison reform with her husband, taking a look at education for freed slaves with her husband. So they're really lobbying for causes, but it's real tightrope. And I think you actually see, you know, that tightrope, you know, really comes to the fore when you take a look at Hillary Clinton and, you know, her role in healthcare reform. You know, the public, you know, first ladies are oftentimes more popular than their husbands, but they've got a fine line to walk on in terms of what their causes are that they choose.
Let's stick with Eleanor Roosevelt for the moment. I just recently saw Hyde Park on the Hudson, and I don't know if you did, but I'm wondering if the public really ever had a true picture of her and of the relationship between her and her husband.
My guess is that they probably didn't. I mean, when you think of what they didn't know about FDR and his disability, and what the press, you know, it's unimaginable to think that the press today would cover up something like that or be complicit in sort of hiding something like that from the public. So, you know, my guess is the answer is no. I mean, she's, you know, she's got a friend, Lorena Hickok, who's living in the White House at the time. I don't think the public really is tuned into those types of things during that time period. But Eleanor's interesting. You know, after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, because she's got a weekly radio program, she's actually the first one to talk to the nation from the White House about what's happening in Pearl Harbor. Now, FDR, obviously, famously, you know, his speech to Congress is what we all remember. But Eleanor, because she has this platform that already exists, is actually the first one of the Roosevelts to talk to the nation about Pearl Harbor.
Was she very popular?
Well, you know, she was influential, but I'm not sure she was as popular as someone like Jackie Kennedy. But on the other hand, you take a look at what she was assigned to do, and, you know, she was, you know, globetrotting, for the war efforts, you know, speaking with troops. So, you know, I don't think she was unpopular. I'm just not sure she reached the popularity of someone like, you know, even Mamie Eisenhower was extremely popular during her time. You know, we look back at her and we think, okay, you know, the bangs and that, and so maybe she was more of a lightweight, but I don't think so. She, you know, actually, you take a look, to me, that's one of the fascinating things as well, is during the 1950s, it's the first time that women outnumber men as far as the voting populace. She's the first one to appear in a television advertisement. So, you know, first ladies, you know, behind the scenes and more in front of the scenes began to play a role.
One of the things, I'm old enough to remember the Eisenhower era, and one of the things that was rumored from time to time about Mamie was the fact that she had a drinking problem. Did she?
You know what? I'm not going to comment on that because I just don't know. But I think, to me, you take a look at someone like Betty Ford, who, as First Lady, has, you know, contracts breast cancer. At that time, it was a real bugaboo to even talk about that. There was almost a stigma. She brings that out in the open. Obviously, after her time in the White House, the Betty Ford Clinic comes about. And so, to me, it's an example of a First Lady having, you know, probably even more of an impact on how we live our lives and people surviving and flourishing than her husband, who was president. Not that he wasn't significant. I don't want to downplay that. But these first ladies do have an opportunity, because of the types of causes that they espouse, to really affect a great number of our lives.
And some of the publicity material surrounding your program, it refers to a look at first lady firsts. Mm-hmm. What are some of those?
Well, you know, Louisa Adams is the only first lady still to be born in a first country, you know, in a foreign country. You know, Abigail Adams is the first to live in the White House, and you think about that White House that she moved into. You know, she did her laundry in the East Room, the grand East Room that we see these presidential events happening from today. I mean, Abigail Fillmore is, again, a name, if history remembers, you know, if she even made it into a textbook as a name, I'd be surprised. But she creates the first White House library, and they are inviting authors and musicians into the White House at that time. And again, you know, I think it's significant that Lucy Hayes is the first college-educated first lady. Eleanor Roosevelt, the first one to hold a weekly radio show. And then, you know, more modern ones, you have Laura Bush is the first lady to do the weekly White House radio address. It was about Afghan women. So, you know, and now Michelle Obama's first African-American and the first one to tweet. So they really are windows under their time periods.
Did you come out of all of this research and all of the work you've done on the series with a favorite first lady?
You know, it's unfair to ask a C-SPAN producer to have a favorite first lady, but I, you know, to me as a group, they're fascinating. But I do look back at someone like Dolley Madison, who, you know, is a beautiful widower when James Madison meets her, and she really is in my opinion, the first lady to take that role and really, you know, take it to another level. She's known for her entertaining, but it wasn't just entertaining that was going on at the White House. She was bringing together people on both sides of the political aisle and doing her husband's politicking for him. She was much more outgoing than he was. She's also a first lady who lives a very, very long life after the time in the White House and comes back to, she's involved with many, many first ladies who come after her as sort of a role model, sort of a, you know, they go to school off of how she ran the, you know, ran the White House and her role first lady. So, you know, it's hard not to like Dolley, but I love folks like Sarah Polk, again, someone who was very, very involved in the decision making that her husband did. And, you know, even poor, you know, Mary Lincoln, I think history gives her a bad rap in a way. One of our historians who advises us for the project said, you know, if she were to be put into the 20th or the 21st century, she probably would have been diagnosed with, you know, potentially bipolar. She would have gotten some therapy and she would have, you know, gotten some medication, and she probably wouldn't have had some of the problems that she did. But having said that, even someone who doesn't have any issues at all, if three of your four children die, I don't know how you'd go on without having some effect of that. And so often it's hard for us to identify with a president making presidential decisions. It's just not something that we do. But these women are influencing their husbands, but they're also the head of the family. And why are reality shows so popular today? Because you have rich people who are dysfunctional, or you've got famous people who have dysfunction. And so many of these, you know, you think about, you know, thrusting children and adults into this spotlight, into this bubble. And so it's, to me, that's a fascinating angle to it as well. What is happening with these presidential families? And the First Lady is really integral in telling that story.
I'd like to go back to Dolley Madison for just a second. You talked about her role. She actually had practice as a first lady with a previous president, Thomas Jefferson, didn't she?
She did. Thomas Jefferson's wife, Martha Jefferson, dies a number of years before he serves his two terms, and he's got his daughter, Patsy Jefferson, in there. But it's really Dolley who's, you know, showing her the ropes, and Dolley who's, you know, I think you can, you know, easily say that she's honing her game for when she becomes first lady. So, yeah, she's got influence over, you know, the Jefferson administration and is helping out. And then all the way really through the Polk administration, she's got influence with first ladies.
Tell us a little about Rachel Jackson. This is a story that proves that politics could be just as nasty 200 years ago as it is today.
Well, Rachel Jackson dies before Andrew Jackson comes to the White House, and he blames her death on the press and on his opposition. It was over the fact that the claims were that she had not gotten a full divorce from her previous husband before she married Andrew Jackson. And it's interesting, our program on the Jackson administration, Rachel is the lead because it sort of casts the shadow over the entire administration. Jackson never gets over it. He has his niece come in to do his White House hostessing, but something happens in Washington that's called the Peggy Eaton affair, and it all centers around this one cabinet secretary's wife who is really an outcast with the other cabinet secretaries in social Washington. And Andrew Jackson is incensed about this because he looks at what's happening to Peggy Eaton and he compares it to the aspersions that were cast on his wife Rachel. As a result of that, his niece sides with the people who are against Peggy Eaton. She has to leave the White House. So there's this, again, this family split over this affair, and it goes back to Rachel Jackson. So it's, you know, theirs was a love affair, but again, it's an example of, you know, his presidency was a bit tainted because Rachel wasn't there with him.
And the media was all over it. What media there was of that day.
Oh, well, the media's been there. You know, actually, Abigail Adams is writing lots of letters to back and forth to John Adams and others. And once he wins the presidency, she basically, in one of her letters, says, "I think I need to tone things down. Now the press is going to be paying attention to what I write." But she, you know, she was writing letters during the Revolution, defending her husband up in Boston, that she would send to the editors of papers. So yeah, the press has always sort of had this fascination with first ladies and presidents and presidential families. Obviously,
I'd like to spend a moment or two talking about Missouri's contribution to first families. That would be Julia Dent Grant, President Grant's wife, of course, and Bess Truman. Tell us a little bit about Julia Dent Grant, because most people don't know very much at all about her.
Well, she's interesting because as you look at this body of first ladies and you focus in on the ones who really loved it, and the ones who did not like it, and Julia Grant loved it. There's this great story about Julia Grant. After 8 years of the Grant administration, she wants him to run for a third term. I'm not sure a lot of other people with what was happening with the scandals in the administration wanted him to run for a third term. But the story is, you know, she's basically leaves the White House kicking and screaming and crying just because she loved it so much. But she's an interesting character because she's with Grant. You know, when you think about Ulysses S. Grant's career, Julia Grant is part of that. Of so many of these first ladies are out there, you know, at these outposts of the different wars that these their husbands were in, you know, really roughing it just as much as they were in a way. So she to me is a fascinating character. And the show, she threw lavish parties at the White House. And also, it's interesting when Lucy Hayes comes into the White House, she really stops this practice of the lavish parties. But also, Julia Dent is famous for getting jobs for her relatives. You know, patronage is a huge part of what Julia Grant is able to pull off. And then you mentioned Bess Truman. To me, you know, it's a tough act to follow Eleanor Roosevelt for anyone. And Bess, she may not have had the press conferences and the radio shows and everything else that Eleanor Roosevelt did, but she sure did have the ear of Harry Truman, who called her the boss. The other interesting thing about Bess Truman is a recent book has come out, and as part of that book, and the papers are now at the Truman Library, you know, her father committed suicide when she was a young girl. And during that, I mean, it's still a stigma today, or it's an awful thing to have a family member commit suicide, but obviously that was something that affected her greatly. And part of the reason she didn't want to do press conferences is because she had this fear that this was going to come up. And this was something so personal to her that, again, it had a huge impact on her life and I would say an impact on her as First Lady.
Well, another thing about her, as I recall, is she really hated Washington. She didn't want to spend the time there like Julia Grant did.
Well, her and her husband are so unique in American history. I think they were a great love match. And I, you know, when they returned, when they left Washington to head back to Missouri, I think they were both relieved. And we actually have a great clip of Harry Truman. He's talking to a group of, it's at one of the presidential library openings, and he says to the group of students, he goes, "Now, somebody out there might be president one day, but I don't recommend it. My, you know, the best time I ever had in Washington was the day I left Washington." And so I think he spoke for both of them, and, you know, they went back to Independence and lived life, you know, right down the street from the library that he created.
Going back to Julia Grant for just a moment, one of the great ironies I thought about her was the fact that her parents were slave owners, which it doesn't match, you know, the history of her husband and his role in the Civil War.
No, and there was some family tension there with her and Ulysses S. Grant because of that, because, you know, Grant was from Ohio, Julia Grant was not, and obviously Ohio's was not pro-slavery as Missouri was, and so there was some family tension there.
One other First Lady we'll talk about before you have to go, and that would be Edith Wilson, who many people call our first female president.
Well, it's interesting. She said, "I never made any decisions. I only decided what to bring into him and when." So you think about the power that she had. Now, this is after Woodrow Wilson suffers a fairly severe stroke and he's you know, not completely incapacitated, but he's not, you know, he's not seeing senators, he's not seeing even his staff, or obviously his doctors are in there. But, when you think about the influence that has, I mean, now, I wouldn't say she was the first, you know, acting president. I mean, it's interesting, Lucy Hayes, there's a great quote in a newspaper article that says, while Mrs. Hayes is out of town, Mr. Hayes will be acting president. And so, you know, I think, again, these first ladies have this role to play in the public, you know, in some ways is more enamored with the first lady over history than they are with their presidential husbands.
It's got to be very, very difficult for these women who probably didn't bargain early on in the marriage to wind up in the position they're in. I think Michelle Obama, it's fairly widely known that she doesn't care for politics very much. She'd much rather be spending time with her daughters.
Well, you even think about someone like Elizabeth Monroe, who did not like being first lady, and you know, as a result of that, ruffled some feathers. And, you know, again, you know, I wouldn't want to follow Eleanor Roosevelt, and I wouldn't want to follow Dolly Madison into the White House. And Elizabeth Monroe did not like the role of first lady. Didn't like being in Washington. Jane Pierce. Poor Jane Pierce. She was, you know, if ever there was a mismatch of a husband and wife in the presidency, her and Franklin Pierce, and she's a very pious introvert. Franklin Pierce is a very gregarious, outgoing politician who even really wasn't up front with her about running for president. I mean, back in those days, he was a dark horse candidate. It was all done behind the scenes, so he wasn't out there politicking, but she did not want to come to Washington. There's actually this letter from her son after Franklin Pierce wins the presidency saying, "I'm so sorry, Mama. I know that you don't want to go to Washington, and neither do I." Now, the tragic thing is, just weeks after her son writes this letter, Franklin Pierce and Jane Pierce and Benny Pierce, their only surviving son, they had lost another son. The train derails, and right in front of their eyes, their 10-year-old son, Benny, his skull is crushed. And so that taints her entire time as first lady. She's not an active first lady. She spends a lot of time upstairs in the White House instead of downstairs, assuming some of those traditional roles that a first lady would.
A lot of fascinating material in this series. Mark Farkas, tell us some of the particulars about it. It starts tonight, of course. It's going to begin at 8 o'clock Central Time here in the Midwest. But tell us how it will be unfolding over the course of two seasons.
Yeah, every night, 9 p.m. on C-SPAN and streamed at C-SPAN.org, we will take an individual first lady for the most part, and we do 90-minute biography programs on them that are really designed, you know, first lady's influence and image is the tagline to the series. And so we're taking a look at the image that the public and the press had about them and comparing that to the influence that they had with their husband presidents. So every night at 9 o'clock from, you know, tonight through June, when we end up season one with Ida McKinley. Then we take the summer off, and then we come back in September of 2013 and really start digging in with the more modern era first lady, starting with Edith Roosevelt, you know, at the turn of the century, married to Teddy Roosevelt, and we make our way all the way through Michelle Obama by President's Day 2014.
Well, Rosalynn Carter and Michelle Obama, of course, are still with us. Did you work with these ladies at all in putting this series together, or is it all from archival material?
For each one of the living first ladies, we'll do original interviews with them. And so as we're, you know, their programs aren't coming up until, you know, late 2013, early 2014. And so the interviews that we'll do with them, we specifically want to wait till we get closer to their program dates so the interviews are updated. But yeah, we will, you know, we've got a lot of great archival material as well. Nancy Reagan, you know, is at this point not doing any more television interviews, but we've done a number of things with her over the years. And so we'll use archival film when we need to.
You have not sat down with Hillary Clinton as yet.
We haven't, but we will.
I'll bet you're looking forward to that.
Well, you know, she was a lightning rod, and obviously she's a potential, you know, candidate for president in 2016, and who knows, maybe we'll have the first man to augment the series after that, but that's conjecture. But yeah, we're looking forward to spending some time with her.
Maybe she'll make the announcement on your program. That would be neat, wouldn't it?
That would be great.
Mark Farkas, thanks so much for being with us, and good luck with the series. Sounds great.
Thank you, Don. Appreciate it.
Mark Farkas' series, First Ladies, Influence and Image, begins tonight at 8 o'clock on C-SPAN, C-SPAN 3, C-SPAN Radio, and will be streamed live on C-SPAN.org. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about New York Post reporter Susanna Cahalan's ordeal with a newly discovered autoimmune disorder and the science behind it. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.